Welcome to all of you. I don't know what your reactions are when you see a statement as a title, Pro-Life Perspectives. The word pro-life has certainly become a catchword that arouses very strong emotions. For some people, that catchword is very positive. It is for them a sign of one of the most significant, or for some people, perhaps the most significant moral causes or moral crusades in the whole world, the protection and saving of the life of the unborn. For others, it evokes very negative emotions. It stands for a certain point of view that seems to some people to deny freedom to women and to depreciate women and their right to choose and all of that. And the first thing that I would like to try to do at the beginning of this session is to lift that word up above, I hope, the abortion controversy. It seems to me, and on this subject, I have discussed this enough in enough places to know that I find that there are a lot of people that don't agree with where I come down on these things, on either side of things, and often I find people on both sides don't agree with me. Well, I don't know what that means, but that I think that many of the so-called pro-life people are really not pro-life in a wide and profound sense of that word. They are rather strongly anti-abortion people, and I don't say at this stage that they should be anything else than that. Then there are those on the other side who are pro-choice people, so-called, who are certainly not anti-life people. They are in many ways profoundly pro-life and take stands on the side of life. And so what I want to try to do is to use this word in a broader, and I hope maybe deeper or higher or wider or something, kind of context. And I don't want to go into a lot of detail in terms of scriptural backing here, but do wish to try to indicate at least briefly that I think this does, the position that I take and definition of this word, the use of the word, is in a basically biblical context. In John, the 10th chapter, in the 10th verse, it says that Jesus came that they might have life and have it abundantly, or have life in all its fullness, as some of the translations put it. That is, in that passage, I think we have the enunciation of what could be called a basically pro-life principle. Jesus also talked, for example, in Mark about how the Sabbath was made for people, not people for the Sabbath. There you have what could be called, I think, a pro-people principle. And all of this, as we were reminded this morning, those of us who were at the session with Jerry Folk, who talked about the fact that life has value, that we are created in the image of God. We think of this in terms of what Albert Schweitzer liked to call reverence for life. There is something very, very basic here. We discussed this a bit in some of the sessions. I wasn't able, because I can't be everywhere at once, to be in all of your sessions, but we certainly touched upon that the other day in one of your sessions, Walter, talking about this. And it struck me then, it seems to me we deal with something that is so profound and so deep, it's in a way difficult for us to get hold of it and define it. It reminds me of those old days back in philosophy classes when somebody would ask you to prove that you exist or something. You suddenly discover, well, that's a little difficult maybe for me to prove that, and yet you know you're dealing with something there that is not just a nothing, that existence is something that is very, very real. And I think that we know that life has value. We know it in the moments of life's joy, and we know it in a reverse way in moments of life's tragedy. That life does have value, and that in Christ we believe that God is on the side of life, that God has created life. He is the author of life. And that that there's something very, very basic in terms of the great theme of the scripture, beginning way back in Genesis 1 and running all the way through, that it is basically a pro-life proclamation. And that above all in the person of Christ, who in whom was life, and the life was the light of people, who came that we might have life and have it in all its fullness. And so what I start with is a bias, or a basic assumption, that as the people of God in Jesus Christ, we are called to be basically, in this sense now, pro-life people. That is, we are to stand for everything that enriches and ennobles and fulfills life. And I think we could talk about certain specific things there. We are to be basically in favor of health and learning and art and music and everything that we believe gives meaning and joy and purpose to life. And at the same time, then we are to stand against everything that is life demeaning and life destroying. We stand against sickness and tyranny and ignorance and hate and whatever. You could go on with that kind of list. Sin essentially is anti-life. Sin is not just against the rules in a book. Sin is something that is harmful. It is destructive of life. Love does no wrong to a neighbor, says the Apostle Paul in Romans 13. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law. Sin is that which wrongs someone. It is anti-life. It is life destructive. Somebody pointed out one time that the word evil is the word live spelled backwards. And I don't know how much we go with those kind of things, but it's kind of interesting little point. But there is some suggestion in terms of that, that evil is that is against life. It is that which is destructive of life. So the basic stance that I would seek to take, and what I deal with here in terms of pro-life perspective, is, as I've tried to briefly outline, that we do seek, as people of God in Christ, to take a pro-life stance. The problem, of course, comes in the tragic circumstances of life, in which life has lost its meaning, in which one life threatens another, in which the rights of one life and the rights of another life seem to have equal right and equal value, and if these circumstances were, it's hard to have it both ways. I was trying to think of some illustration of that, and I don't know if this is a very good one that came to mind just this afternoon. Was if you think of the situation in the Mideast with the Palestinians and the people of Israel and so on there, some seem to think, as we've studied that a little bit, and others are experts on this, I use it only by way of illustration, to have equal right. That you can make a case both ways. And there, in that situation, you come into conflict. And that is also true in all kinds of ways in terms of these specific, complex, difficult, agonizing issues of life and death. Now, I have a hunch that we would pretty well agree that in Christ, God is on the side of life and wholeness, and that we are to stand for those things that give life meaning, stand against those things that demean and destroy life. But we get into the specific kind of issues, abortion and capital punishment and war and euthanasia and suicide and so on, the whole question of the consumption of goods and the care of the earth. There are all kinds of implications here and aspects of this. I think there's where we get into very difficult and complex questions. And I want to say again that I do not claim to have the answer to all those questions. What I would like to do this afternoon is to make one basic general statement that, at least so far in my pilgrimage, has been helpful to me in approaching these questions. And then very briefly run down and make a few comments related to some of these specific issues. And then open it up and we have discussion and share your questions and insights concerning these matters. The basic statement that I would make at the beginning is, starting from a pro-life perspective, or in the pro-life principle, or pro-people principle, or we should call it. And that is that as consistently and basically pro-life people, I think we are called in Christ to take our stand against all institutionalized killing. Now, we've had some discussion of this, of the institutionalizing of killing, in sessions we've had earlier this week related to war. And I want to try to make a distinction now in a broader way between what might be called exceptional killing and institutionalized killing. I think that's a very basic kind of distinction. And I want to try to get into it by way of illustration from areas that are not related to killing. And the first one, and I use this by way of illustration, is to make a distinction between institutionalized slavery and exceptional slavery. We know that in the history of the United States, and in many places elsewhere in the world, we have had institutionalized slavery. That is, the holding of slaves has been a legally accepted part of the system. been part of the economic system, the social, cultural patterns of the society. We have had institutionalized slavery. And I think that all of us here today would agree that it is a good thing that the institution of slavery has been abolished. I think we might also unanimously agree that there are certain circumstances in which people, individual people, or maybe even sometimes groups of people, would need to be, in effect, deprived of their freedom. That is to say, they'd be enslaved. That is, if I would, for example, become even much more deranged than some of you may think I am already, and I would become a threat to myself or to you, you know, you would not hesitate in saying that I should be confined, I should be, you know, hospitalized, or perhaps if I had done a crime or something, I should be put in prison. We have ways in which those that kind of slavery, if you want to put that in quotes, we may see to be necessary, but we do not jump from that to the approval and acceptance of the institution of slavery. I think in a parallel kind of way, there's a difference between racism in the United States and racism in South Africa. Racism in South Africa is institutionalized. It is part of the accepted society. It is legalized. It's part of the way it is. And racism in this country is, in a way, an aberration. It may say more the way it is. Hopefully it is an aberration. And we think it is well, again, that we have moved in our society away from the institutionalizing of racism, which was certainly present in our society and in some ways still is present. We could go on and get off on tangents here and talk about institutionalizing of sexism and so on. There are many other examples of that as well. We could, by way of imagination, I suppose, think of societies in which we have institutionalizing of lying or of stealing. It takes some imagination of that. We could all, I think of examples where you say in certain specific situations it would be the right thing to do to tell a lie. I've sometimes said to kids in confirmation class, if somebody comes to your door with a machine gun and says, I've come to kill your parents, are they at home? You do not have to tell the truth. You don't have to say, yes, they're upstairs hiding under the bed. You can instead say to them in good conscience that they left for Hawaii this morning or something, whatever it happens to be. I mean, we grant those, in those exceptions, we think there are exceptional circumstances where it may be right for you to steal the gun from the thief who has come to kill you or something. But that does not mean that we thereby jump from those exceptional circumstances to saying we think that lying ought to be the established pattern of the society or that stealing ought to be. Maybe these are kind of far-out illustrations, but they hope to make a suggest or something, a difference between exceptional taking of life and institutionalized taking of life. Now, with that little background, an attempt to make that distinction, I want to quickly run down some of these specific areas of controversial issue. And I want to start with the one related to war because of the fact that we've talked about that a number of times already, and there's been a lot of discussion of that this week. I don't want to spend much time of that here, but do want to say a little bit about it. I personally believe that the greatest establishment for killing in the world is the war-making establishment. War, as we've thought in some other sessions, is not just a spontaneous eruption of hostile emotion between individuals. It is planned for, it is built into, it is prepared, it is studied, it is institutionalized. I think there is a great difference, for example, between killing in war and killing by a police force. Police officers are sometimes in circumstances in which people are killed, but that is really, those really are, in the sense that I try to use it today, exceptional kind of circumstances. A police officer, well, killing is a last resort for a police officer. A police officer is responsible, will certainly try to bring a person in alive. The person is then tried in a court of justice and under rules of law and so on. You don't have police forces measuring their success, at least not responsible ones in a Christian context, in terms of the number of people they kill. And a police officer is someone who I think takes that very, very seriously. Now, in war, killing really is institutionalized. I don't want to get barbaric about this and say that everybody who's in war and army is just intending always, you know, to kill as many people as possible. But the intention of a battle in the structures of our society is to destroy the enemy. And I think this is an very important and significant distinction. We talked again at much more length about distinction between war and police power the other day. I don't want to repeat that, but I think there are very significant distinctions there. I think this was implied again, or it was stated really this morning in the discussion with Jerry Folks' discussion about just and unjust war, that the basic meaning of the just, unjust war teachings is that Christians are not to fight in war. But there may be some exceptional circumstances. And he sought to point out what some of those exceptional circumstances might be. Now, I think those exceptional, what has happened in terms of the just, unjust war teaching is that the exceptions have become the rule. As we mentioned in one of the sessions the other day, I think we search history in vain to find a situation in which the majority of Christians in any country have ever stood up and said the war that our country now is fighting is unjust. There have always been some people who have done that, but not the majority of people who have done it. I think that the war also involves... They say the first casualty in war is the truth. I think that's probably true. The next casualty of the war certainly may be reverence for life. There's the old saying that's supposed to be attributed to Joseph Stalin, that one death is a sorrow, 10 deaths is a tragedy, 1 million deaths is a statistic. And I think we get into certain kind of mathematical immorality when we get into war and calculations in these terms. Some have suggested, incidentally, what ought to happen is we ought to have maybe 100 or so of the children of the leaders of each of our nations, Soviet Union, United States, should be living in the opposite capital. We should have 100 of the children of people in the United States Senate and the President, administration, and so on. They should be living in Moscow. And we should have 100 of the children of the leaders of the Soviet Union living in Washington, D.C. Or a similar kind of way related to reverence for life, that Roger Fisher, who I had the privilege of sitting in on one of his classes this last semester now out at Harvard, has made a suggestion that I think is a very interesting one, and I share this by way of a little, in one sense, comic relief, and yet also in relation to the basic issue we are dealing with here in terms of pro-life perspective. He comments that the code needed to start a nuclear war is usually carried by a young military officer who accompanies the president wherever the president goes. And he suggested what ought to happen is that we should put that needed code in a little capsule and then implant that capsule right next to the heart of a volunteer. The volunteer would carry with him a big, heavy butcher knife as he accompanied the president. If ever the president wanted to fire nuclear weapons, the only way he could do so would be for him first, with his own hands, to kill one human being. The president says, quote, "George, I'm sorry, but tens of millions must die." He has to look at someone and realize what death is, what an innocent death is, blood on the White House carpet, its reality brought home. And Fisher goes on, "When I suggested this to friends in the Pentagon, they said," and again I quote him, "my God, that's terrible. Having to kill someone would distort the president's judgment, and he might never press the button." Well, I think we rightly chuckle at that, and yet something about that isn't very funny. Because we get into situations where there is this kind of institutionalized killing. It is very different from face-to-face dealing with people in a relationship in which we have at least some measure of reverence for life. I want to just go on quickly over these other issues, and then we talk about them. The abortion question is certainly one of the most agonizing and complex and difficult that we deal with. I think that in the United States and in a lot of the world, it is true that in legalized abortion, we do have an institutionalized form of killing that is rightly very disturbing to those of us who are basically pro-life people. I think the Supreme Court decision that was made served to take a very significant step toward institutionalizing that kind of killing. And from my own perspective, I think the Supreme Court decision was a mistake. I have rather strong convictions about that, but I want to go on to say at once that I have far less strong convictions in terms of what the proper kind of action and legal apparatus ought to be. This abortion question gets into all kinds of personal and moral and legal dimensions, and I do not claim to have the answer in terms of what the best legal action ought to be. I feel about this somewhat the way I went through and agonized as I was a member of the Board of Regents for a term at St. Olaf, and we had discussion a number of times related to the alcohol policy on the campus. Now, I came to the conviction that I think St. Olaf College's alcohol policy is inadequate. I don't think it's a very good policy. It's a simple policy of prohibition of all alcohol on the campus. And as an effect of that, what exists, I think, at St. Olaf and many other places is that you have alcohol every place on the campus except in the catalog. There is much alcohol on the campus, but not in the catalog. There are two policies. There's one unwritten policy for the campus, another policy that is written for the constituency, or some whatever you want to put that. I don't think it's a very good policy, but I think it's also very difficult to write better policies. I think there might be better ways to write policies there. I tried my hand without too much success in the board of getting policies written, but I share that by way of illustration. I think it's easier for us to say that something is inadequate than it is for us to come up with something that is better. Now, again, this is a huge subject. I would share just some of my own convictions here from what I think is a consistent, attempting to be a consistently pro-life perspective. I think for one thing, about which, again, I personally have strong convictions, I think that the official stand of the Roman Catholic Church related to the questions of abortion and birth control is basically inconsistent. It seems that if we are going to be pro-life people, then we also ought to be people who affirm responsible family planning and birth control as the gift of God. And that here, as I heard some time ago on the radio, a quote from one of the Roman Catholic cardinals, that the three great evils in the world were abortion, birth control, and euthanasia, then I have some problems, because I think that to put birth control in that lineup is to very much misplace it. And I think that it's the kind of question that we need to be speak on in the Christian church in terms of a word of affirmation of family planning as the gift of God, and not to present it as something in terms of sin. When people say their prayers about family planning, I hope that most of those prayers are prayers of thanksgiving and not prayers of confession of sin. I think also the whole abortion thing has gotten into areas in which abortion has become a symbol. I attended a big rally out east in which it became very clear to me that for many women, at least the ones who were represented at that particular rally, that abortion was the chief symbol of women's liberation and equality of rights, full freedom for women. Now, I really think that I am a strong advocate of equality between men and women. I think that's very, very important. I think one of the best things that's happened in the history of humanity is the women's liberation movement. I think that, as I mentioned in a little discussion in one of the earlier groups today, someone said once that whenever the light goes on, the bugs gather around the light. I think that's true of any movement, or any person, whether it's Jesus or Luther or anybody else. You can get a fanatic fringe. I think the women's right movement is basically, essentially sound. But I also believe that latching on to abortion as one of, or perhaps the chief, abortion rights as the chief symbol for that, is to latch on to that which is a mistaken symbol. I think, I don't know what better symbols would be. I suppose for men to talk about this may be inappropriate in some sense. Maybe it would be better if women had really made a basic affirmation of males taking responsibility for pregnancy in some way, or some similar kind of thing would be much better. As I said before, I don't know what the best legal actions are. I guess from my personal perspective, I would like to see a pro-life amendment that doesn't relate just to abortion. I don't know if it's possible to write that. A pro-life amendment that would be broad and would stand in opposition to all forms of institutionalized killing, and which would provide for those tragic exceptions in which we believe it is necessary to have an abortion or in some other circumstance to take a person's life. I think that there are circumstances in which it is necessary for there to be abortion. I think some, if it's a tubular pregnancy, for example, I don't think anybody disagrees with it. There are some where the life of the mother is threatened. It's a question exactly in how you make the application. Yes?
I just want to comment. It's all nice in theory and it sounds good. But when you talk about making an amendment that broad, there's no way you're going to get people to agree on what are the exceptional cases.
I know. I say that in a general kind of sense, and I think I put in the sentence, I don't know if it's possible to do such a thing.
Yeah.
But I wish, all I'm saying in making that kind of statement is that I wish we had in our society, somehow, a strong pro-life affirmation that would stand against, and I would want to go on here, stand against war, against capital punishment, against institutionalized euthanasia, against institutionalized abortion, and would still provide for those tragic circumstances. And when I say that, I think that is very difficult to do. I think the just war people attempted to do it, and I think what happened is, in terms of just unjust war, is that the exceptions became institutionalized.
What do you mean by institutionalized abortion? You mean welfare mothers?
No. I have tried very hard to make a distinction, which I know is very difficult to make. Have mercy on my lack of clarity in making it. I've tried with the examples of institutionalized slavery and exceptional slavery, institutionalized war and non-institutionalized, exceptional killing in war. I think you get a situation in which abortion in some societies, much more in the United States, anybody can have an abortion. That's anybody who wants it. Any stage of virtually, you can have an abortion. I think that's wrong. I think it reflects something other than a basically pro-life, reverence for life position.
I know when we get to this point,
I know what happens. We get stirring such very deep emotions that it's difficult. I'd like to just take a couple minutes if I could, and we do have almost half our time left, just to say a word about capital punishment, euthanasia, and suicide, and a much bigger subject only mentioned in three sentences, and then we'll throw it up and open for discussion, and I hope to learn from you, because I do not have the answers to these questions. But I think it is appropriate for us as Christian people to really agonize over those questions. Just a word very quickly in terms of capital punishment. Capital punishment, again, I'm glad to come from a state that doesn't have capital punishment, because capital punishment is institutionalized killing. It is set up within the structures of society to kill people. I personally am against capital punishment. I think it is possible, it's not difficult for me to think of circumstances. The life of the mother is threatened, in which abortion, I believe, is the thing that needs to be done. I think that's true. I can think of those circumstances in relation to many of these issues. I find it difficult to think of circumstances where I believe it is justified from what I call, a consistently pro-life position to justify capital punishment. Some people will justify capital punishment by saying it deters crime. I don't think that's true, but from my personal perspective, I would be opposed to capital punishment even if it did deter crime. And if that seems strange to you, I think we might deter thieving by cutting off the hands of thieves. I think it might greatly reduce the amount of thievery in the country if everybody who stole a candy bar out of the five and dime store had his hand cut off. But I'm against it. I think that's barbaric to cut off the hands of thieves. I think it is barbaric to cut off the hands of people that you hold in a prison. I think it's legalized murder. If you have strong feelings on the abortion question, I confess to have even stronger, clearer feelings on the capital punishment question. I know for some people that also is a very, very intense question. And I know that many, many people who are strongly opposed to abortion, they are absolutely on the march against abortion. They are people who are in favor of capital punishment. They are in favor of institutionalized militarism and so on. We get into, as I said at the beginning, I find among my friends that I've got people on both sides of this question who don't look at things the way I look at them. And that's just fine, especially in a place like this where we open it for discussion. The question of euthanasia. They're very difficult, mercy killing. They're very difficult questions here. I think that all of us here would agree that the kind of euthanasia programs that we think of when we think of Hitler and some of that, of taking the people out of society who are unproductive and just taking them out and killing them, we have an abhorrence to that. That's really, again, institutionalized euthanasia. At the same time, those of us who have been in circumstances where we stand by the bedside of the person who is in great suffering, or these are agonizingly difficult questions. I mean, I personally, in some ways, find it in a situation of a person who is, say, you know, 98 years old, who has lived a full life, who is now in great pain and anguish, and so on, and who has very, there is not the promise of health and wholeness of life. You know, I think I find it easier in a situation like that to think in terms of not only turning off the machines, but even possibly in terms of some active euthanasia. Some people are appalled by that. We've had a situation in our congregation just the weeks before I left here of a woman who had a stroke, a one-side stroke. She had surgery to clear out the artery on the other side, and in effect, she had another stroke on the other side. She had double stroke both ways. She never came out of a coma. What are they going to do? She died. In that situation, I think people think of death as a blessing. We talked about last night, some of you were in this discussion about living after loss. There are times when life has lost its meaning, when it's full of suffering, we think of death as a blessing. But even in that situation, if the doctor could have come in and said, we've got a cure for this lady. Tomorrow she will have fullness of health. We immediately would not think of death as being a blessing in that situation. We think of it as a blessing only when life has lost all hope and all purpose. And I know there are differences between passive and active euthanasia. But those two are agonizing differences. What do? Let a person starve to death? It'd be more humane to give them something. These are very, very difficult questions. Yes?
I think it's complicated by the fact that in our medical world, we have made such advances that we can keep somebody alive indefinitely, where in God's natural plan of things, even 10 years ago, those people would not have survived. And, you know, where do we have the ethics of keeping somebody alive indefinitely since we have the means to do it?
Oh, those are absolutely right. They're tragic things. I do think one thing that I wanted to say in connection with this, I think situations of brain death are, technically speaking, not cases of euthanasia. I think when the brain has died, the person has died. That's another thing we might talk about in connection with abortion. There are some who say if we use brain death as a definition of the end of life, we should use brain life as the beginning of life, which is a very interesting kind of concept to think about. And we may want to get into that a little bit. Just a word on suicide, and then a final word on this other whole vast area of consumption and carelessness. That the suicide question, again, is one that is very, very difficult kind of thing. That I certainly do not want to stand in condemnation for people who've committed suicide. I've had funerals for people who committed suicide. I think of one situation of a woman who was an absolutely marvelous person. We spent hours and hours together. The people in the first parish where I was. And one day she hanged herself in the basement of their home. That does something to you, I kid you not. And I said at the funeral service, and at her funeral, that I thought that Jean died of an illness. And I really believed that. I think she died of an illness. And I could go into that, we could talk more about that. There are other situations where you cannot say a person died of an illness. There may be tragic circumstances in which suicide is a responsible course of action. But I still am glad I don't live in a society where, again, to try to use this expression, maybe they're better. I hope you can help me to find better ways to express this, where we don't have institutionalized suicide. That is, where you can go into the drugstore and buy a death pill. You know, anybody who wants it can commit suicide anytime they want to do it. Yes? It's in a tragic circumstance of some kind. I think that's where we get into the difficulty. And the difficulty, seems to me, is the exception becomes the rule, as in the just war thing. The exception has become the rule in practice. Thank you, Mom. That's helpful for me to have you clarify that. I hope it's helpful for others of you as well. Most people who are prevented from committing suicide are grateful for it afterward. People sometimes say it's a free country. If people want to kill themselves, they'll kill themselves. I think a basic reverence for life, pro-life kind of stance would say that we should seek to do whatever we can to prevent suicide from taking place, and at the same time, we do not stand in judgment. Condemnation against those who do. There's the old rules here about these things. We may even laugh at them. You know, a person committed suicide, they couldn't have the funeral in the church, or they're buried across the fence outside the cemetery and all that kind of thing. I think there's something barbaric about those kind of rules too. Then finally, one last thought. You know, we talk about this whole pro-life perspective or pro-life principle in terms of these kind of controversial specific issues. I can't end this without saying that I really think that one of the most basic and most difficult areas does not just relate to these kind of things, it relates to the very patterns of our consumption and of our carelessness. There are some people who have used very strong illustrations, and I want to use one without saying that I affirm it, but it's one that prompts our thinking. Some have said that the industrialized West, the rich world, and especially the United States, is a cancer in the body of humanity. And that we are consuming and exploiting and wasting in ways that we are causing the deaths of people. We are living in an anti-life way. It may not be anti-life for us right now. We may be, you know, rich and overweight and all that kind of stuff, but the way we are living may be a way of death for people. One of the most significant things on this study leave, I wanted to focus specifically on issues of peace and war and arms race and justice and those kind of things. I picked up one day a copy of Jeremy Ripkin's book, Entropy. And maybe next week we could have some discussion of that book. But if what that book talks about is right, we've got some, and there are many other similar kind of books, in terms of our responsibility for the future of the planet. I don't want to even go into that. We haven't time to talk about it. But we live in ways today that may make it impossible for our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren to live after us. We may be living out ways of death. And so when we talk about this, I think it's important to keep it also in that kind of a broad context. Well, now, I want to quit. We've got 20 minutes left. I want to just open it up and await your insight and wisdom on these very complex and difficult questions. Mr. Meyer.
In regard to capital punishment, I've never owned a hunting license in my life, so the fact that I can't kill animals, I certainly wouldn't want anything to do with killing a human being. However, I do feel that something needs to be done to somehow revise our prison system Well, I feel that the biggest ripoff in welfare that we have is our prison system. It's about $20,000 a year for a prisoner, which would take care of several, poverty families. And
that's more than a year at Harvard.
Yeah. And prisoners that the other day was objecting to getting only three stations on TV, where you have a lot of senior citizens. If you saw the TV sets that they had to look at, and other people that don't even have a TV where they can get one station good. However, I don't think that putting people to death or so forth is the answer, but I do think that we need to revise our prison system so that instead of us taking care of the criminals, that the criminal somehow or other assumes a responsibility towards society. For example, if someone steals, all right, then let him work that certain amount off. When that debt is paid, he's freed. Someone else, if he steals a lot, well, then he's going to be in prison a pretty long time in order to work that off. But I do think that we need to have something done because when you look at statistics, I know one time when the temporary warden of the Nebraska Penitentiary was there, while he was saying how 70% of the people in Boys Town wound up in the penitentiary. Well, in here, Boys Town was looked upon as such a, wonderful a means of things. So people wind up in prison again and again and again, and there is nothing there of that they have any responsibility toward anyone. And I think if we could work out something where there's a responsibility, I think we would deter crime a lot more than to say lock someone up in a solitary cell or put someone to death or do things. But I do feel that we're not wrestling with really deterring crime by what we're doing now. And I fully agree that capital punishment is not the answer, but we do need to do something that we're a criminal assumes a responsibility instead of being a ward of the state.
The whole prison reform question, of course, is a vast, huge question in its own right. It'd be interesting if we had people here who want to spend time specifically discussing that question. Some might say in the Boys Town thing that the Boys Town was effective. It kept 30% of the people out of jail, those boys out of jail. Yeah. Maybe that, I don't mean to be cynical about that, but some would say these people coming from what backgrounds they came from might have...
Also made somebody rich.
Yeah, I don't want to defend, I don't know about Boys Town. Hand over here.
Well, I don't want to, you know, enlarge on the subject either, but you didn't mention gun control. That has ramifications in this whole thing too, doesn't it?
Oh, my... There's an old saying, you pick an apple, you shake the tree. And I think when we deal with issues like this, it touches upon all kinds of issues we haven't talked about today.
And has nothing to offer.
Of course, the economic part is a part of it. It seemed to me on some of these questions that the economic factor gets to be out of proportion in its significance. We're talking the night after the forum on the discussion about alternatives to war and so on. I think in some ways, and these are agonizing kind of questions. We have people in our congregation who work in the production of missiles and so on, and I think sometimes we get into situations where you talk about that, the economic factor gets overpowering. It's like going into a situation of talking with the tobacco farmers about lung cancer or something. I wonder what I would do if I'd inherited a farm from my father who got it from his grandfather growing tobacco, feeling the way that I feel about there's a pro-life kind of thing in terms of the whole matter of the use of tobacco in our society. I think that that's another specific kind of area. I got to quit talking. You got a hand up, sir, over here.
Well, I just do. I do visit a prison very regularly, and I'm part of a program which is called IT. And
IT stands for?
Well, it's interactional transition, which is an attempt to get persons out of prison.
Uh-huh.
Very interesting. Prisoners themselves do say that they do feel that there's a percentage of the populace that probably cannot handle themselves outside of prison. But my reaction, is to the term pro-life. Pro-life assumes anti-life. And I must indicate to you that there are large numbers of Lutheran Christians who, by use of the same scriptures, have not come to the, quote, pro-life position. I would feel that it is unwise for me to say anything other than to indicate to you that, as a student of the scriptures, I cannot agree with all of the positions of pro-life, though I can agree with many of its positions. And I think because we represent this very broad spectrum of people, I need to say personally to you that one of the greatest treasures that my church has given to me as a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant male is the ability to talk to young ladies, assuming that they have within them the Holy Spirit and the capacity of decision for their life. It's what is best for them and best for the possibility of a child which may be brought into the world or may not be brought into the world. And I'm glad that I am part of a congregation and part of a church that permits me to make that option to my people openly, honestly, before God.
What is that? Would you sharpen the issue a little bit more?
The Lutheran Church of which I'm a part made a statement 10 years ago that said that the individual is the one upon whom the choice finally devolves. The church will not decide whether or not abortions can be made or ought to be made. But ultimately, the person themselves must decide in the light of their situation. And I'm glad I don't have to talk about anti or pro-life, but that I can talk to persons about their circumstance. So I guess my only reaction is I hope that pro-life does not get to the place of taking away from me my ability to have that leeway in talking to fellow Christians about some very important decisions.
No, I want to just clarify from my own perspective on this that as a pastor, for example, I certainly counsel with people related to abortion questions. I think, too, that they have to make their ultimate final decision. I think that's correct. However, I would not want to say that that means there is neutrality there. I will say if somebody comes in to see me and she says, I am now, you know, I may make it a case that was the kind of case that would come into mind for me. That suppose this person is 5 or 6 months pregnant, and she and her boyfriend are planning to get married, and now the boyfriend has run off with some other woman someplace, and she has decided, I think in her anger, she says, I'm going to go have an abortion. Now, I cannot, in that counseling situation, I try to be a rather non-directive counselor, but I cannot, in that situation, simply shrug my shoulders and say, that's up to you. You can do what you want to do. It doesn't matter. Because there is, from my perspective, another life involved there. This is one of the difficulties I have with the Supreme Court decision that, among other things, and I won't get into all, and I'm not an expert on all of this, where it deals with viability. That is to say that if the child can survive birth, then you should not have an abortion. If the child cannot survive birth, it's all right to kill the unborn child. Well, as you, somebody mentioned it before, the scientific developments are such now that, you know, that time when a child can survive birth gets moved earlier and earlier and earlier, and you get even the situation of transplanting embryos and all kinds of stuff. It is not that simple a question to simply say to someone, it's your choice, because I think that in that situation, you have two lives. It is an agonizing moral decision. I think in a society that would simply say, that's perfectly all right, there you have institutionalized something which, to me, is contrary to what I would call a consistent, and I can't claim for the pro-life theme, but I use that to try to express something that seems to me to be in our Christian faith. Yes?
I agree with that, and I think that often the Supreme Court decision that allows abortions has been abused greatly in the country. However, I would hope that our government would never take away the right of a woman to have an abortion when she feels that it's legitimate. And often, I think it is more than two lives involved.
Well, there are many lives.
Sometimes, you know, it's an entire family involved. And there can be many reasons that abortion could be a legitimate choice. I think where heavy responsibility lies is on the church in providing ethical counseling, theological counseling, and support for the families in their decisions as to whether or not to continue this pregnancy. I too am bothered greatly by abortions at 5 or 6 months. Before that, when there are reasons that have been weighed carefully, I think there are many legitimate reasons for an abortion. My greatest fear is that the choice that is ours now through the Supreme Court will be taken away so that, again, women who find it necessary to have an abortion will need to go to back alley situations to do that. So I guess at this point I would say, you know, what we need is more counseling and more ethical forums, theological forums, so that people can come to decisions.
I think also responsibility of the church, I try to indicate, goes way back before the time the pregnancy occurred.
Yes.
I think there we also really have failed. Yes?
I can certainly agree with a large amount of what you say, but I think that along with this counseling, particularly when you have women, young girls who are standing alone, you've more or less got to say, look, I will give you support. I will babysit for this child while you finish your education until he's five. I'll come through with money. On weekends, I'll take you out, or we'll have you into our home, or something like this. It's not enough to have it beforehand. They've got to have monetary support. They've got to have emotional support. They've got all sorts of support. And I don't see it coming forth from the so-called pro-lifers. Have they come forth and say, oh, we'll do this, this, and this. We'll be there to help you. I don't see it.
I have a feeling that some people are equating your presentation with the pro-life movement, and it's not that at all.
I don't
know.
Because the pro-lifers are saying,
I think my position doesn't fit well on either side.
I'm just going to have to say that, okay, it's fine to have counseling beforehand.
Well, I agree.
But you've got to have the support afterward.
And
they're concerned about the life.
They're just concerned about the pregnancy, and then after you had the baby, bye-bye.
There was, maybe you read the letter to the editors in Minneapolis paper by Ellen Goodman. And it was a 12-year-old mother who was up in court for neglect of her child. She had been abused by her stepfather, pregnant at 11. The court decided, oh, they certainly couldn't have an abortion. That would be too traumatic for this child. So here the child was 12 years old, and the baby she had was being neglected. Her stepfather was in prison. Her mother was in an institution. What do you expect of a 12-year-old girl? But where were all these pro-lifers who were going to come forward and give support?
Well, there are many, many aspects. The whole adoption world is another area where people who cannot... I mean, you stand in line for adoption. It takes a lot longer to get a baby by adoption than it does by other old-fashioned method that people are able to do so.
I agree, but obviously this girl or these parents or whoever it was not going to adopt out this child.
Well, I know, but I mean that part of, I think that's again part of education responsibility in terms of, I think for many people who are a child like that, a pro-life decision, I don't know that circumstance at all, but a basically pro-life decision toward that child in terms of now fullness of life would be to say, though it may break my heart, I'll place this child for adoption. That might be a much more pro-life decision. Yes?
Okay, I would just like to comment on what these two women have said. I agree totally with what they're saying. I think abortion is a problem, but it is the surface problem. And there are all of the underlying problems. Why does a woman want to have an abortion? Well, she wants to have an abortion because she's alone and she economically cannot raise that child. She wants to have an abortion because she is in college and she does not feel she could continue in her education with a child. I know for a fact at St. Olaf that while women who become pregnant and are unmarried are not told to leave, it is highly suggested. So I think that there has to be something done that gets at the root of why the abortion is to be done, and that's where we need to start working to eradicate those kinds of problems. Also, in response to your solution of adoption, I have always felt that adoption, oh, that's the perfect answer. There are so many people that would love to have a child. And we all say that a woman who has an abortion goes through so much emotional trauma and all that kind of stuff. But I think we have to weigh what kind of emotional trauma you're putting any woman, whether she's 12 or 30, that carries a pregnancy within her for 9 months and then has to give that up. I think that is a real emotional trauma.
Well, that's what I say. I use the expression that breaks her heart. I say it may be a pro-life decision. Yes.
I'm an adoptive parent, and I've struggled with infertility all my married life, and I think that for me, the adoption of a child was the greatest gift that any woman could have possibly given to me. And I don't think that we spend enough time as a church affirming that option for women who become pregnant in an undesirable point in their life.
Okay, yes.
I'm basically in agreement about what your position is on pro-life. The question I have deals with, in a society such as ours where what the 51% say is what's right, mm-hmm. How can you go to someone who's not a Christian and say the abortion you're considering is wrong?
Well, I would say a similar, if you want to just make it on the basic right and wrong kind of thing. I think if there's somebody in the society who has a child that's a year old, and the person's not a Christian, they say, I don't like this kid, I'm going to kill it. I think that's wrong. Mm-hmm. I can say that to anybody. And I think that the person does not have a right over the total life of that child. And I think that, I agree, I think in the abortion thing, it's always much easier when it's very early. Earlier the better. That's why I relate to this thing of brain birth as one option. I think the Supreme Court thing is arbitrary, dividing up the pregnancy into these trimesters, which is a way of dividing 9 by 3 and so on, but there aren't those essential differences.